The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members learn more about us, our programs and priorities, and especially our people. In this series, we introduce you to our Global Association board members, the people who steer the organization through sound governance and financial management and ensure that we advance our mission. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we welcome your feedback at media@100women.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amanda Pollinger, CEO of 100 Women in Finance. In this next installment of our Meet the Board Member podcast series, I'm delighted to introduce you to Armando Senra. Armando and I first met when he was nominated to join the 100 Women board a couple of years ago, and since then he's played an important role in the organization's governance. Armando is noteworthy for being the first man to serve on 100 Women's board, and I'm excited to talk with him about that aspect of his experience. A bit about Armando. A managing director and member of BlackRock's Global Operating Committee, Armando oversees BlackRock's sizable iShares Americas business. Earlier, he served as BlackRock's head of Latin America and Iberia, responsible for all business activities and markets across the region. His work with BlackRock dates back nearly 30 years, including his early career at Merrill Lynch Investment Management, which merged into BlackRock 15 years ago. He's worked internationally and led teams located across Europe, Asia, the US, and Latin America. Experiences I'm sure help to inform his governance role with 100 Women in Finance, given our own expansive global membership and programming scope. So welcome, Armando. Let's begin with your background. Would you share a bit about your upbringing? And as you look back at your formative years, talk about early ambitions that motivated you to pursue a career in global asset management.
Hi, Amanda. Great to join you over Zoom. Hope everyone is staying safe and healthy in these very difficult days, but it's great to be able to connect. Let's see. I was born in Mexico. My grandparents migrated to Mexico after the Civil War in Spain, and I lived in Mexico until we went back to Spain when I was seven. I grew up in Madrid, where I lived until I moved to the U.S. For my sophomore year in college. And since that time, I've spent most of my life between New York, London, and Spain. I came back to New York in 2012. I'm married with my wife, Laura, who was born here in New York, and have two little New York girls, Libby and Sophia, 3.5 and 1.5. I think that if I reflect back, my upbringing definitely shaped some aspects or my perspectives and passions. I was very close to my maternal grandparents, as my parents got divorced when I was very young. Son of immigrants, I did a lot of traveling when I was young, thanks to my grandfather, primarily all over Latin America and Europe, and I loved that. It was a dream to visit so many different countries, have so many experiences, try different cultures, food, customs. My grandfather was a very pragmatic man. He was happy doing business in any country with anyone, regardless of their race or background, as long as they were honest and hardworking. And I think a lot of those values of hard work and appreciation for, in many ways, the struggles of immigrants, but also the benefits that immigration brings to societies, the desire to meet and connect with people from different backgrounds, the desire to do business globally, that really shape a lot of my views and perspectives and in the future of my career. I think it was also interesting because at the same time, after we moved to Spain and my parents got divorced, I saw my mother struggle to have a career as a divorced mother with a little kid. Spain back in the 70s was a pretty close-minded society. It's hard to imagine now. But she had done extremely well in college and she was very well educated. But Spain was not ready at the time to have to deal with a woman with a little kid in the workforce. Of course, a lot has changed in Spain, but the essence of that struggle, unfortunately, remains, which is, one of the paths that led me to 100 Women in Finance later on in life. As to the question as to, you know, hopefully that shapes some of my perspectives. But to the question of why I went into asset management, that's a very good question, to which I have no really good answer. You know, I can tell you why I stayed in asset management for so many years. In the early days after having joined Merrill Lynch, I did not have asset management in my mind. But as always, a good mentor and sponsor of mine back then led me to join what it was called then Merrill Lynch Asset Management back in 97. And I've been in asset management since then. From my early days in college, I was very interested in financial markets. But I didn't really have a clear idea as to where my career would take me. I liked building businesses. I liked financial markets. But it was not like asset management was necessarily in my mind. Now, what changed is, you know, once I joined MELAM, Merrill Lynch Asset Management, I really loved the business. I loved our mission. And it felt a lot more long-term oriented than other jobs in finance. I was lucky to have tremendous mentors and sponsors that have kept me challenged over the years. I was very happy to have been involved in some of the most interesting transactions in asset management. I think that that's a big part of it. The acquisition of Mercury Asset Management shortly after I moved to London in 98. Later, the integration of Merrill Lynch Investment Managers after the acquisition of BlackRock. Later on in 2009, the acquisition of BGI. You know, and the integration into BlackRock, the first time that we combined active and index. And then as head of Latin America, you know, being able to lead the acquisition of Banamex City Asset Management in Mexico. I think that, you know, like it was a combination when you look at that really interesting work, having had the opportunity to have so many opportunities that I was able to explore, building and running businesses, leading teams in different places around the world, interacting with really interesting people. And I think that also, you know, having a mission, which, you know, like as an organization, where we are incredibly client-centric. And at the end of the day, you need to have kind of like a purpose and a mission that is higher than having a great career. And I think asset management provided that, you know, like when you humanize a lot of the things that we're doing, you have to put faces to the assets that we manage on behalf of clients and how we're helping clients achieve their hopes and dreams. And I think that all combined with, you know, that availability to really, you know, travel the world at the same time and meet people from different cultures has been an incredible privilege and incredibly enriching.
Thanks for sharing all that. And I know that when we chatted just, you know, before this call, you know, you talked about all of the things that really put you in a great place to lead teams from different parts of the world, very diverse teams. And I think you've just given people a really good sense as to why that came about. And it's interesting, you know, one of the things that you shared with me was that you actually love photography. And I asked you to send me some photographs, which maybe we'll share with alongside this podcast. And what's really interesting in those photos is your focus on the individual, on the diversity, and I know some of the photos were of people around the world, some of them were of animals, some of them were just of landscapes, but they do really reflect that sense that you love diversity and you love different cultures. So it really came out in the photographs that you shared with me. So I thank you for that kind of description of where you came from, because I think it does really help instruct, you know, why you're doing what you're doing right now. So obviously you work at BlackRock, which is one of 100 Women in Finance's Leadership Council members. BlackRock, as everybody knows, is the world's largest asset manager with approximately $7 trillion in AUM. And my understanding is that BlackRock's ETF or iShares business is nearly a quarter of that total. BlackRock recently announced that your company specifically and all asset management firms more generally have a critical role to play in responding to the climate crisis. And this idea of kind of being active for good is actually something that at 100 Women in Finance, we talk about a lot. As part of our own Investing in the Next Generation initiative, where we're encouraging pre-career young women and millennials to appreciate that a career in investing can be a meaningful way to be a force for good in our world. You know, it's actually really interesting to see firms like BlackRock coming out and saying a very similar thing. So I'm just wondering if you'd reflect a little bit on this theme of investing for good and share your perspectives about the role that investors and perhaps the finance industry more broadly can play in that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, right? Because I think that after the financial crisis, there was this general sense that working in financial services meant working for the evil empire. Movies is another one of my passions. So Star Wars is out there, right? But it really felt that, you know, like if you work in finance, you know, you were the evil group. And I think that that's just plain wrong. And, you know, I was mentioning a little bit about it earlier on, but, you know, I'm not saying like in any other industry, we may not have had our share of bad actors. But I strongly believe that working in finance can be a powerful force for good. And I think that that's something that we need to really work on and emphasize and regain the strong reputation for honesty that we had for a long time. You know, I think that I go back to asset management and BlackRock, and you mentioned trillions of dollars. And, you know, again, you have to humanize that. So put one of my photos to that comment around the trillions of dollars, right? We manage, a lot of the money that we manage is for pension plans around the world. It's not our money. It's the money of teachers and doctors and nurses and firemen and police officers. It's their hopes and dreams that depend on us, retiring in dignity, achieving, you know, their savings to buy a house or to send their kids to college. And that gives us all at BlackRock, and is one of the words that if you listen to our founders is repeated over and over again, our fiduciary responsibility. It is not our money. It's the hope and dreams of many people. And that gives us a strong sense of purpose about the work that we do. So, you know, when you mentioned the commitment to sustainable investing, I think that, you know, we have a strong voice because of the size that we have. And, you know, we got to use that strong voice to have a real impact in the world we live in. And it can be a powerful force for good. Helping investors with our voice recognize that, you know, ESG-related risks play an important role in asset pricing. That's a very simple statement, but all of a sudden, it really helps reframe the conversation so that investors around the world and how people value companies, they will be thinking, okay, what are these factors that can have a real impact in the pricing of a company? So this is not about whether you believe in climate change or not. The fact is that climate change has, you know, poses an important risk in the value of a company. And by just simplifying that conversation, I think that we can have a huge impact on how, you know, we value companies that have better governance, companies that treat their employees and the communities they live in better, companies that worry about efficient use of resources. And these voices that we have will drive awareness to the issues, will drive awareness in this case to ESG, and therefore will drive also more disclosure of what companies are doing in sustainability, will drive disclosure as to, you know, specifics on what they're doing with resources, what are they doing with their employees, how are they forming their boards, the overall governance of the company. And that will drive flows. And ultimately, I think that it's a combination. I think that that's good for investing, but that's also good for the world. And we have a meaningful impact. So I think that one doesn't exclude the other. And I think that, you know, in the values of our company, how we think of the assets that we manage and the responsibility that we have, we can be a force for good. And we have to use our voice. We cannot just be silent because ultimately it's not our money. So I think that purpose, that sense of purpose is the soul and heart of a company. and is what drives us forward, and ultimately is what will help us attract the best talent to join BlackRock. And I think that in finance overall, in the industry, we just have to do a better job in utilizing our voice to really amplify how we can be a force for good, how we are a force for good. And I think that will help also, you know, in our mission to bring more great talent into this industry.
Yeah, so I love the fact that you reflect on the fact that, you know, it's not about giving up profits in order to have good outcomes, but actually those positive outcomes from a social perspective around the world actually are going to probably lead to greater profitability, to better investment outcomes. And I also love the perspective that you have on future, on talent, and how we're going to attract the future talent in this industry, because I do think that there's a real issue, particularly with millennials, around viewing this industry in a very negative, from a very negative perspective. And I think as an industry, we haven't done a great job at communicating what we are doing in terms of making a difference in the world. And as much as there are some wonderful nonprofit organizations out there doing wonderful things, whether it be in climate change or in other social impact, you know, areas, actually, given the amount of assets that a BlackRock has, for example, the ability to actually create meaningful change in the world is much greater. I'm beginning to realize it's much greater actually than you know, necessarily joining a nonprofit and doing it from the ground up. So I really appreciate your views on that. Perhaps I should add a question that we actually didn't have in the original one. That is, how do you think, it's related to what we are doing as an organization, 100 Women, but how do you think we can change that perspective that future talent has around our industry, particularly for young women looking at our industry? I mean, is it just doing more of communicating how we're investing? What are some of the things that you think we should be, as an industry, doing a better job at in terms of getting that message across?
Yeah, I think I think whether it's for women or just in general to attract better talent, to emphasize some of the you know, what we just mentioned, you know, in terms of how we can have a real impact on people's lives. I think people want to have purpose, and I think more than ever, you know, you mentioned millennials, you know, there's that sense of purpose will really drive people towards your company or your industry. So amplifying that message is important. I think that also, and this is interesting, you know, because as horrible as it is, the situation we're going through now, I do see some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of how we change of working from home, flexible schedules. And I think that that's something that we have struggled in the past. And I think that, you know, in general, it will help us. I think that the more that we get used to a more flexible, but not less productive, I would argue, you know, like I can tell you in the last few weeks, I've been incredibly productive, almost too productive, because, you know, you don't have a separation in between your time at home and your time in the office. So it just feels like one continuum. But we have proven that working remotely and flexible timing or flexible workspace works. And I think that that will be something that will also help us in the future. And I think that specifically with women, you know, I think that that's one of the things that we struggle in the past. You know, like I mentioned my mom. My mom was raising me, as, you know, I wouldn't say a single mom, had my grandparents, but, you know, ultimately it was very challenging. And I think that there's a level of flexibility that was required back then. Sometimes we lose incredible women that go on to have kids and they never come back to our industry. They go to other industries. We got to get them back in our industry. And I think that a lot of that has to do with, one, a clear sense of the purpose and the mission. I think that that goes for anyone. Two, you know, how do we implement more flexible, more balanced approaches to the work that we do?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, you know, as you know, the board in 2019 of 100 Women adopted a new guiding, what we're calling 30 by 40 vision for the finance industry, in which we're wanting to see 30% of women in investment teams by 2040, and also 30% of women in senior executive roles by 2040. And the whole messaging around what this industry is about, how you can make an impact, and actually what you've just talked about, which is the fact that actually out of this crisis, hopefully we can demonstrate that actually this isn't an industry that necessarily requires you to work, all hours every day in an office environment. I do think that there's going to be a big conversation that happens in the industry around what's worked out of this crisis, and certainly, flexibility of how we work is a key piece to getting to a place where women don't leave the industry. I really do believe that. So thanks on that. And thinking about women in our industry, what's interesting about your role on the board is that you are the first man to be on the 100 Women board. And I'm just wondering, you've come into an organization that is primarily women. We have men as members, of course, but, on the board, everybody else is a woman. And I'm just wondering if that experience, which hopefully hasn't scared you off too much, that experience, has helped you reflect on what it feels like for members of your team, for example, in being the only one, and whether you've been able to use some of the sense of you being the only one to enhance, your team's experiences within your firm, and anything else that you want to reflect on in terms of what it feels like to be the first man on the board.
I gotta tell you, I still remember when I when we had our first meeting with the board, and I was the only man in the room, and all of you were talking, and of course I was the brand new one and the only man. And I look around, and I still remember thinking, "Oh, I see. So this is how it feels." And it was really interesting because it was definitely an interesting moment. And although I would say one of my passions, and we talk about that, was, building teams. And I do believe deeply that diverse teams are better teams because of the different voices. But that was like a moment of this is not a team that I built or a team that I'm part of. This was a moment where I'm in the room and we're in the board meeting and I'm the only man. And it really helped me understand, I get it now. It has really shaped also, how I incorporate different voices, into a team discussion. And I think that's one of the biggest struggles sometimes we have. I mean, it would be easier to have a team of clones of myself because then we would all think the same way. But obviously we know that that's not a good strategy for team building. When you build a diverse team, by the fact that it's diverse and that we're not all the same, and not everybody behaves in the same perspective, it's harder to manage that type of team. But at the same time, if you utilize the voices that you have, it's almost like you're running an orchestra with all these different instruments. But you got to be able to allow for each instrument to be heard. Otherwise, they get drowned. And I think that, the realization of how do we think better about how do I get all these voices to participate? And, some people may be introverted, others extroverted. Some people may be very aggressive but how do you get them all to communicate that voice? So I think that, that's one of the very simple realizations that I had just being there. And look, ultimately, I cannot lie to you, and I've mentioned that before, and we laughed together. Like, I thought at the time that I was proposed for the board, I thought that was some sort of social experiment that it was being played on me. But I had the opportunity to build diverse teams at BlackRock and also promote and develop the careers of many women. So I was very excited. And I think bringing the voice of men into the room is very important to overall the mission that we have in 100 Women in Finance. We cannot do it alone, and you cannot exclude 50% of the population. So I think that you need the voice of men. We need to do it together. We need to bring more men into our tent and really with the same understanding of what's the mission. So, you know, I think that it's been phenomenal, but definitely has brought in some new ways of thinking of team building, and, you know, how do I think of women in the workplace, and, you know, how do we integrate all the different voices?
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you sharing that. We're very happy that you were part of our social experiment. So with that, I think we will bring this to a close. And Armando, I look forward to seeing you, whether it's virtual or in person, at our next board meeting. Thanks so much for joining us.
Same here. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you for everything you do. Thank you.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members in the private section of our website, Community.